You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm happy because my guest is Deborah Eisenberg. She's the author, most recently, of a book of stories called Under the 82nd Airborne, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and before that, a book called Transactions in a Foreign Currency, stories that I think are currently available from Vintage, and a play called Pastoral. Well, these are such amazing stories, and it seems to me that you have the best idea about confusion. You know, what drives these stories are, you know, the ongoing question, almost always to the final page, who are these people and why are we with them and what are they doing together? Yes. And it's a very thrilling thing to have existence, in other words, become the suspense of a short story.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that makes me so happy that you say that. I mean, I love the idea that it kind of goes on the page uncooked before it's cooked.
Do you put it on uncooked?
Well, no, not at all, in fact. I slave and slave and slave, and everything takes me forever. So there's a process of sort of eternal refining that goes on, but I don't like it to show.
Well, of course, but nevertheless, one can tell when in short stories where so many things stay so thrillingly unknown for so long, one knows that there has been a constant working up to ineffability.
I mean, I think of it sometimes as building a very, very, very solid foundation and then putting some little strange thing on top and knocking the foundation out.
Although sometimes there are places where you can see through, you know, little chinks. I think I found one in the first book when I suddenly read what it was like seeing Chris, I guess for the second or third time, and realized that this young girl who goes to her eye doctor on the pretext of seeing this boy who is lurking in the bar across the street, that the title was about seeing Chris, literally.
Yes.
That, you know,
yes.
That finally this was about not just being able to perfect one's vision, but to be able to see through Chris as
yes.
well.
Yeah.
How did that wasn't something that you, what did they say, knew from the beginning. That was in the course of writing the story?
The title or the idea or
the
both.
Idea.
The idea, I never know what I'm writing about until after I've finished. Well, until after I've finished, for example, the next to last draft. I don't, I mean, I think that your mind does all this work that you really shouldn't interfere with at all. So I just work and work and work without really exactly knowing what it is that I'm doing. I mean, how do I explain this? I mean, I can always tell whether I'm doing something properly or improperly, but I don't really know why until extremely late in the process. And no, I had no idea that that was what was going on in the story until I was really very, very far along with it.
Do you like Jane Bowles?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I have a feeling because, you know, the only other place I know of where there's so much interesting stuff left out, and what's left out is there shining its spotlight on what remains. Jane Bowles is one of those places where I feel like most comfortable because the material becomes so foreign.
Oh, great, yes. Yeah.
Well, I've had a notion that if you read her, and not many people do, that you would really get a big bang out of Ivy Compton-Burnett.
Oh, I love Ivy Compton Burnett. Okay. Oh, I just love her.
That quality of a bell rings, and then the next 8 pages of the novel is spent with the characters trying to decide who, if anyone, will answer the door if indeed it has rung. You know, there's some disagreement. It might have been the wind or next door. And this, you know, gives me enormous pleasure, not to mention the fact that they're talking about answering the door when, in fact, the situation in an Ivy Compton Burnett novel is inevitably that all of these people have had incestuous relations of one kind or another, and as a result, they're so identified that they can't decide who should answer the door.
Oh, and those children. Nobody can write children like that.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, I wanted to ask you, you know, all of these reviewers of Under the 82nd Airborne have commented on your ear, and it's unavoidable.
It's sort of my good luck that I have a kind of empty head, so things tend to rattle around in it.
Leaving echoes.
Yeah.
But somehow you must have known that you were good at that, because the first thing that you did write is a play, and again, even from the very beginning, each line has a bead on a certain kind of life that seems captured.
I loved writing that play, and actually it's the second thing that I wrote, because the first was one of the stories in the first collection. And the play was commissioned by someone who, through a sort of long, not terribly interesting chain of events, the story was performed as a reading. And then the play was commissioned, and I really had no intention of writing a play and didn't think that I could do it. But having been offered money, I really was required to write a play. There was, I mean, absolutely no alternative. But it was such an incredible pleasure for me, once I started, to find out that I didn't really have to do anything except listen. And all I had to do was sit there and listen and sort of transcribe. I mean, it took a few months for the characters to sort of form in my head, but once they did, they just took it away on their own, and all I had to do was transcribe.
One of the first things I noticed about transactions in a foreign currency was the funny way in which descriptions would mix the concrete with the, I don't know how to say it, metaphysical, almost as if the character's thoughts had a quality of becoming like pottery in the air. There's a strange enjambment of mind and atmosphere that takes place around these characters' heads. I wondered if you noticed that, because it's literally there in the descriptions, this weird fusion between air and the thoughts in it.
No, I never have.
Uh-oh.
No, that's incredibly interesting to me, and it must be a sort of reflection of, I mean, one of those deep reflections of personality that is the writer's, that is, in this case, mine.
I think you mentioned in an interview somewhere that your reader is as disturbed by the shifts of tone in these stories as you are. And because there is a kind of alertness to interaction in these stories, it's very pronounced and textured and felt, but also slightly nauseating.
Yes.
Because the characters are so easily disturbed by small things. Their concerns are very local, and so they are almost hilariously blown about by stray conversations. So it's almost as if interaction becomes like weather in these stories.
That's That's right. That's absolutely true. And I'd like to keep it that way.
I'm curious. It must take a very long time for one of these stories to become finished. How do you know when they're done?
You know, I find that such a sort of intriguing issue, because I don't know how anybody else knows when they've finished work of any sort, of any artistic sort. And I don't know how I know either, but there's simply no doubt about it, usually. I mean, occasionally I get sort of lost or stuck, and I have to show something to, you know, I have a few good readers that are like specialized physicians on call that I can give things to at a certain point. I don't like to show people anything until I'm certain that it's finished, but if I have to, I do. And then, of course, with a very, very good reader, you get very, very useful misreadings. And from that, you know where to go. Or whether you're finished or not. But usually there's no question about it.
I've always wondered about those things. I think it was Harold Brodkey who had said to me that from time to time he would hear from William Maxwell misunderstandings of such a very high order that it changed the course of his writing career.
Wow, yeah, I can believe that. But of course it does, you know, because every really highly articulated and responsive misreading is an instruction. You know, so you know where further to go.
Do you find, you know, these stories, I guess they give me as much pleasure as they do, because while, as you say, one doesn't feel the effort of the writing, they're definitely written stories. They're not, I don't mean to say that they throw all of their attention on the act of writing itself, but rather that one knows that one is in the hands of a writer rather than someone skillful, say, with an anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
When you show things to others, do you find it more helpful to show them to other writers or to, you know, laymen?
Actually, I do prefer to show things to writers. That is usually how it works out. And I do feel that... you know, it's funny, I've been thinking a little about painting recently for various reasons, and I'm always kind of maddened that, in a way, to look at painting requires some familiarity with its history, and I almost sometimes am simply weepy with anguish about that, because I feel, well, I don't know the history and it's not fair. And I always think writing is different. But that's not, I've realized that that's not entirely true. Writing has a different relation to its own history and a different relation to the culture. But really, this is something that I've really learned, I think, from teaching a bit, that people don't just pick up something and read it unless they've read a lot. It's hard to read difficult things. You can't just do it unless you're very familiar with writing and your mind becomes tuned to writing just as your eye becomes tuned to painting, with experience and familiarity. So I do tend to go to writers.
I'm talking to Deborah Eisenberg, the author most recently of Under the 82nd Airborne. I think that one of the things that I enjoyed most about your stories, you know, those people who do write and read and care about those things are likely to be the people who remain unformed for the longest time, not knowing what to do or who to become, or so busy imitating everyone that you never become yourself quite. And that's, you know, that quality is very much caught in your fiction, of an unformed person, perhaps a waitress who doesn't yet know whether she's a writer or an actress, is in the field, if it is one, of meeting interesting people and then retiring in fear from them. but, you know, I think, in other words, that these stories address something very primal in the soul or spirit of a reader who is not him or herself yet formed.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I mean, I certainly drifted around like a little ghost for most of my life. And I mean, I would say in a way there's a sort of coalescence of interests there, because, of course, you know, this is my experience, but also I have quite an interest in unforming myself the minute I feel formed.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
it's hard. I'm not sure I can. It's always, I mean, it is the writer's problem and mandate, in a way, to always see things not as a cliché. I mean, it's just one long, huge, endless battle with cliché. And as soon as you sort of hack away at some kind of underbrush, well, it just grows up again in some other place. But, you know, there's just this endless, tiring task of sort of mental deconstruction that lies ahead all the time. I mean, not that it's not fun. Of course it's fun. But how does one do it? I have no idea. Just by, I suppose, recognizing the cliché.
Well, I remember, you know, when I was young, I would go to museums and choose the least interesting picture and stand not only immobilized but riveted in front of the picture, almost as if I were expecting, you know, mesmerization rays to form between my eyes and the canvas. But my real intention was to see would other people stop attending the act of attention.
Yeah.
And inevitably what would happen if you stare at something attentively enough is that you do deregularize the rest of the gallery, and a clump of people, a fistful of people, will stand around you looking at the quality of your looking. They're no more interested in the canvas but in the attraction of art. And I do find that you can sometimes make or force that deconstruction of experience by slowing it down, by paying too much attention to it, by trying to pretend that everything around you is happening backwards, you know, and you're only understanding it in reverse afterwards. You know, do you play those games?
Not consciously at all, but I think... Yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of my time dislocating myself in various ways.
But you don't have rules for dislocation.
No, no. Although it's such a good idea, maybe I'll try and construct
a handbook. Well, you know, it's sort of, you know, when I must have been a very self-conscious kid, but, you know, when I would wake up in the middle of the night, I would wake up with questions like, what would I be saying if I were talking in my sleep? I guess that's
could
not
you ever question. Answer that?
Well, it was odd because I think ultimately I always thought that if I spoke in my sleep wherever I was, like Dorothy back in America with Glinda looking through the mirror, that if I spoke in my sleep, I'd always be talking to my parents, no matter where they were.
Yes.
And so if I woke with a desire to be speaking, I'd have to ask myself, what would I want to say to my family? You know?
My God, you know, I think maybe that's what talking in one's sleep is.
Yeah, I think that might be.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to sleepwalk, but I never could.
I wanted to, too. Well, although I can't imagine anything scarier. I went to camp with the girl who did. It was simply electrifying.
Did you see her?
Yes.
Oh, my. Can you remember what she looked like? I've never seen it, and I'd only see it on television shows.
No, I can't. I remember what she said, which now you will remember forever, too, because it's totally unforgettable. She said, "Hup ho, run up the tent, run up the tent."
Hup ho?
Yes.
That's great.
Isn't that amazing?
Where was the camp?
I think it was in Upper Michigan. It's part of the many years of my life I can't really remember, except for that phrase.
Uh-huh. Well, I always thought of it as being sort of like relay races where someone would walk as if they were holding an egg with a spoon with an egg in it, you know, that there would be something very ginger and that the walker would be completely unconscious but in a posture of complete care and attention, which I guess I always liked because I was so unfocused when I was young that I would have to work very hard to stand up straight or to look at anything. And I'd be working so hard at it that I wouldn't see what it was I was looking at, but I got the posture right.
God. You know, I do think that's exactly how I think of sleepwalking, too. And it's so strange because it's sort of the opposite of what you think the word means. And it's really, I guess it's a very, very complicated word, like collaboration, that means many sort of seemingly mutually exclusive things. And it's so interesting because it sort of, doesn't it show up a lot in literature, sort of European literature between the wars?
Well, all of it, amnesia, sleepwalking, phantom limbs, That really was a determinant. And when you read the poetry of T.S. Eliot, it all seems like, you know, the result of some kind of anesthetization because of gas or bombing. That even that whole phrase, dislocation of sensibility, that became famous around Eliot, seems to me to be the product of the sleepwalker culture, you know, between the war, after the war.
Yeah.
Your new work in Under the 82nd Airborne, Deborah Eisenberg, is, speaking of that, more political than the work in the first book. And you mentioned somewhere that an essay of Adorno, when you finally understood it, had turned you on. I don't know. I found myself thinking as I read these stories, she's politicizing post-politicized culture. And then I thought, well, what does that mean?
What does it mean, Michael?
I have no idea. But, you know, these voices.
Yeah.
I wondered if you might say anything about the politics that have entered your work.
I am what I think of as a basically apolitical person in the sense that I really don't, I'm not terribly interested in what goes on from day to day, here or there. But I think probably you're referring primarily to the stories in the book that are set in Central America. But what really sort of reoriented me to literature as a sort of form of political expression or vice versa in some way was a trip to Eastern Europe, strangely, before all this happened, really in 1986. And, you know, it was so amazing to meet people who were not allowed to know about themselves. And it really was like being deaf for them. And it was sort of brought very vividly home to me how much the world is what exists in the minds of the people who live in the world, and how precious a commodity then one's own peculiar, very limited, idiosyncratic, and even sort of maimed brain can be. And so I began looking at my relation to the world and discovered that, in fact, I was someone who lived in the world. And it sounds rather obvious, but actually it was kind of a big surprise to me that I had this kind of reciprocal relationship to the world. And if there were things happening in the world, then it was my position either to witness those things or not to witness, to testify or not to testify.
It seems that from the very beginning, though, these are stories frequently of the powered or the empowered and the powerless, even on the simple basis of, you know, a diner in a restaurant and his haughty bearing to a waitress whose secret fantasy is to be haughtier, or the conscious and the unconscious, but including in the status of consciousness people who have decided not to know what they know.
Yeah. Well, of course, that to me is the most fascinating thing about being an American now, is that everyone has really taken that on. That is the need to not know what you know. And we've really gone into it in a deep, elaborate, and sophisticated way, and just found every possible way to not know what we know. And when you go outside America, by America, pardon me, I mean the United States, it suddenly becomes extremely clear things about yourself that seem simply impenetrable turn out to be very simple, very clear. And yet we've sort of perfected the technique of not knowing what we know.
Beyond endurance.
Yes.
Beyond the permissible boundaries.
Definitely.
I've been talking to Deborah Eisenberg, the author most recently of Under the 82nd Airborne, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, a book of short stories. Thank you for coming around. I've always wanted to meet you.
Well, thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My engineer on Bookworm is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.